Welcome to Broken Capitalism Lecture 3. Today we're going to be talking about one of the most popular types of intervention in the free market, one of the most popular ways to interfere with the free market, in which is tariffs. And one thing I find a bit odd about tariffs is on some aspects of economics, the basic argument is a little difficult to understand, like the Austrian theory of the business cycle, it's not, or the socialist, maybe even the socialist calculation argument. It isn't something you would expect the man in the street just to pick up very easily. You have to take courses on it. But the basic argument against tariffs, as we'll see, is a very simple one, but people keep calling for tariffs nonetheless, in spite of this basic argument. So one thing I'm hoping to do in this lecture, we'll be able to grasp what the sort of basics of tariffs in a very easy to understand way. So we'll see exactly that it's not a very difficult fallacy to analyze. Now, Mises places his discussion of tariffs within a more general category that he calls restrictionism. It's not perhaps not a very common term, but this is what he calls it. He classifies the tariffs as restrictionism because it's a restrictionist intervention, as you might suspect from the name, is one that tries to restrict production, but this is a little misleading. It's not misleading. Suppose you had some measure that says, don't produce something, like we're not going, some people were kind enough to start talking about wrestling. So suppose the government just said, we don't want people to watch wrestling anymore. We're banning all wrestling shows. No more, Vince McMahon is out of business. We're just banning his whole operation. So that would clearly, we see why that would be called restrictionism. We're saying he can't produce the service anymore of professional wrestling. But Mises also counts as restrictionist measures that divert production from what it would have been on the free market. So supposing you have a tariff on foreign cars, then the result will be that people will tend to buy more American cars. So they're not buying fewer cars necessarily. They're still buying cars, but it counts as restrictionism in Mises' usage because it's diverting production from what it would have been otherwise on the free market. So just have to be a little careful there. When he's talking about restrictions, it doesn't just mean measure that ban or reduce a certain type of production. It's ones that divert production from what it would have been on the free market. Now, here you have to be a little bit careful. What Mises means by a restrictionist measure is that one that directly aims to change production. Just as an example I gave, suppose you say, we're banning all wrestling shows, no more wrestling shows. Well, that's going to change the production of that service. But there are other laws that can have an impact on production but don't directly target production. And you would expect this because, after all, the aim of production is consumption. So if you have something that targets production, it's going to affect consumption. If you have something that targets consumption, it's going to have effects on production. But nevertheless, we can distinguish between laws that directly aim at production and ones that directly aim at consumption. An example, let's compare two laws. One, suppose you have the government forbids growing marijuana plants. say, yeah, you can have a lot of things in your plant pots if you want, but no pot in your plant pots. So that would be a restrictionist measure because it's saying you can't produce this anymore. This fits what we were saying before. This is directly targeted at growing these plants. So it's restrictionist. It's saying you can't produce this anymore. Now, let's suppose there weren't any laws forbidding people from growing marijuana plants. You're perfectly free legally to do that, but you have another law that says people are prohibited from buying it or from using it. So that wouldn't count as a restrictionist measure because it's not directly targeting production. It's just saying you can't buy it or use it. You'll be arrested if the police catch you with it. Now, this is obviously going to affect production if the government is able to enforce that law because people won't be interested in producing marijuana if they're not going to be able to sell any of it. I'm not talking about the black markets, just in the legal market. This is definitely going, assuming the legal market's the only market, then if you have a law targeting consumption says you can't use it, it's definitely going to affect production, but it isn't directly targeting production. As I say, it doesn't say anything about you can't produce this, or it doesn't regulate the prices at which people can produce marijuana or impose a tax on them. It's just saying consumption is forbidden. So that's going to affect production, but it doesn't count as restrictionist on Mises' usage because it doesn't directly target production, it targets consumption. You see the distinction between the direct effect and the indirect effect of a law. This, I should say, in case those of you who've studied moral philosophy, you remember this is a very important distinction in moral philosophy. It's called, some people believe that's called the doctrine of double effect, where it's wrong, according to those people, something is wrong directly to intend something, but it might be all right if it's a foreseen consequence of what you do. For example, some philosophers, I'm not arguing now whether those people are right, would say if you're in a war with somebody, you can't directly target civilians, you can't directly aim to target civilians. But if you say you bomb some military installation, you foresee that some civilians will be killed, that might be all right in certain circumstances. You see, the same similar kind of distinction we're making here. A restrictionist measure is one that directly targets production. You can have other measures that have indirect effects on production, but as long as they're not directly aimed at production, they're not restrictionist. Now, as I mentioned before, the restrictionist policy that we'll be talking about in this lecture is a tariff. And as you no doubt know, a tariff is a tax on a foreign product. For example, suppose there's a tax on cars from foreign countries sold in the U.S. So someone manufactures a car in a foreign country, then if they want to sell it in the U.S., if someone wants to sell it in the U.S., they have to pay a tax on the car before it would be allowed in the U.S. for sale. So, for example, suppose you have a tariff on foreign cars, then people who import Toyotas made in Japan will have to pay a tariff on those cars, and that will raise the price of the car when it's sold in the U.S. That much, I think, everybody knows. Now, what would have happened if you didn't have a tariff? Then the foreign car would have been available at a lower price because, remember, the tariff is a tax, so it's raising the price of the car. So then it might have been the case that American customers would have bought that car rather than an American car. So we're imagining the case where, say, the Toyota a lot of people would, if he didn't have a tariff on the Toyota, a lot of people would like to buy that because they think it's a better buy for their money than whatever the equivalent car is in the U.S. I have no idea what that is because I'm one of the few people in the U.S. who can't drive. Several people tried to teach me many, many years ago, but it was a complete disaster. But never mind that. Okay, so a lot of people say would if they had a choice between Toyota and kind of an equivalent American car, if there's no tax on the Toyota, they might take that. Maybe the Toyota people can sell it, their car, at a lower price than an American car that's roughly similar. But with the tariff, that raises the cost. So now people are going to buy the American car. So what we have then is, or it should be, I shouldn't have said production, it should have been I thought I made a mistake, but I didn't. Okay, the production of cars that American buy has thus been diverted from Japan, at least in part, to the U.S. So without the tariff in the free market, people would be buying Toyotas, or some people would. And then with the tariff, they're not going to be able to buy Toyotas because the tariff has raised the price of the car sufficient so that people now find the American cars a better bargain. They want to buy the American car. So the production, the cars that Americans buy, has been changed from, at least in part, from Japan to the U.S. So that's why the measure counts as restrictionist, because it's changing production from what it would have been in the free market. Now, when we talk about tariffs, we have to distinguish two different kinds of tariffs. Of course, two different functions of a tariff. One that we've just been talking about, we're talking about a protective tariff. So protective tariff, as the name suggests, is trying to protect an American product by making it harder for foreign competitors to sell their products in the U.S. It's imposing a tax on the foreign sellers, so they will find it more difficult to compete with American producers. Again, to get back to the Toyotas, they will have to charge a higher price for their car because of this tax than they would have charged without it. And that's going to make it harder for them to compete against the American car manufacturers. And this is what a protective tariff is. It's restrictionist in Mises' sense because it's aiming to divert production from what would have been in the free market. But there's another sort of tariff, which is a revenue tariff. That's a particular way of raising money. So, say the government, in order to exist, has to have money to carry out its activities. And gets this, of course, it can have deficit spending where it spends more than it's taking in. But if without that, it has to get money by taxation. Now, one way we have various kinds of tax, we have income tax, sales tax, but one way the government can raise money is to impose a tax on foreign products. And in fact, in the United States, most of the 19th century, certainly through up to the Civil War and beyond that, tariffs were the main way the government raised money. So a revenue tariff will affect production because, say, the importer of the foreign goods will have to pay a tax on these goods. So that will affect how production, because he won't be selling as many, you know, because of the higher cost of the goods. But that isn't the aim of the revenue tariff. The revenue tariff is just aiming to raise money. Now, of course, a tariff will normally be doing both of these things. Say if you have a protective tariff, it will be also raising money, say trying to protect the American industry, but the tax doesn't go, it isn't just given to the American firms that benefit from it, goes to the government. So protective tariff is a way of, will generate revenue also in most cases. And a revenue tariff will, to some extent, protect American businesses from foreign competition. We can still distinguish the two because we say, again, what is the aim of the tariff? Is it to protect a particular industry or product, or is it to raise revenue? So we can distinguish between protective tariffs and revenue tariffs. So I say those are two things that a tariff can do, protection, revenue. And to some extent, those goals can conflict. For example, suppose we had a tariff that was so high that it just wasn't reasonable for any seller of a foreign good to import the good into the U.S. Say we had some enormous tax on foreign cars. Let's say on a $10,000 car, we impose a 100% tariff. So the car now costs $20,000. Well, probably, it seems very likely, nobody's going to want to sell this car for $20,000 in the U.S. because it's just a $10,000 car without the tariff. So people won't be importing any of these cars in. So in that case, you'd have a very effective protective tariff. It would completely protect the American industry, but it wouldn't generate any revenue. So if you want to ask, what is the relation between what tariff will generate the most revenue, will very often not be the one that would give you the most protection. You could have ones that give both, but again, there are two different aims for the tariff. And what we're talking about in this lecture is protective tariffs rather than revenue tariffs. Now, one point, if you've done the reading, we had readings from Mises, Rothbard, and Hazlitt. It's always nice if you can read three great figures like that. I think one of the advantages of this course, and of course you have to put up with my lectures, but one of the advantages if you do the reading, you get really in contact with some outstanding minds. I think that's always, that's one of the great features of studying these Austrian economists. I always find when I do the reading, most of this I've come across before, but I always pick up new stuff when I'm going through with it. Now, one thing, if you've done the reading, I think you won't be surprised that Mises, Rothbard, and Hazlitt are against tariffs. It's pretty clear if, say, they were asked, say they were called in to advise the government, should you impose tariffs, they'd say no. But it isn't the case, at least for the most part, that their criticism of tariffs are based on value judgment. It isn't they say, well, you shouldn't impose tariffs because tariffs go against the particular values that we hold. So somebody could say, well, I don't hold those values. Let's say somebody's Travis mentioned mercantilism. Well, somebody said, well, I'm a mercantilist. I just want the government to accumulate as much gold as possible. That's what I value. So you might value other things, but this is what I want. who are you to put your value judgments against mine? For the most part, you'll see why I say for the most part, that sort of point wouldn't tell against Mises, Rothbard, and Hazlitt at all, because what they're doing is not saying that, and again, with this proviso, I'll remember this and we'll see why it comes in later. For the most part, they're not saying tariffs go against our value judgments in such and such ways. Rather, they're just describing the effects of tariffs. They say, if you impose a tariff, such and such is going to happen. And that's a completely scientific statement. They're saying, this is going to happen if you do this. So then people who know these effects can then assess whether they're a good idea. Now, to use analogy, Mises makes somewhere, although I don't, not in the readings we have today, sometimes says, well, it's just like, suppose you go to a doctor and he says, if you smoke cigarettes, you'll increase your chances of getting lung cancer. So that isn't a value judgment. The doctor's just telling you, this is likely, this increases the chance you'll get lung cancer if you smoke. Then it's up to you to decide, well, do I want to smoke given that fact? Now, it might very well be that everybody, practically everybody, will evaluate the consequence in some way. Like, even smokers wouldn't say, oh, isn't this a great idea? Now I know I can increase my chances of lung cancer. I'm going to really start smoking now. Almost no one at all would say that. We think somebody said that would be crazy. But just from, it wouldn't fall, of course, that people wouldn't smoke. I mean, they might have reasons for smoking that to their mind outweighed the effects in causing disease. But from the fact that everybody or nearly everybody would evaluate a certain effect in a way that people might not like something, that doesn't make the statement that it has this effect an unscientific one or one dependent on value judgment. Just like, again, that example, the doctor tells you if you take an aspirin, it'll make your headache go away. Most people want their headaches to go away, but that it's still the case that it's not a value judgment to say if you take the aspirin, it's going to make your headache go away. Now, we can now get to what is the basic we have a question from Malcolm, I mean. He says, I understand that Mises said it makes arguments against tariffs with our value judgment, yet one does this, one value peace be a value judgment. So then if one argues that tariffs incentivize conflict, wouldn't that be a value judgment? No. You see, suppose you say tariffs promote conflict. That wouldn't be a value judgment. If somebody said, I don't want there to be more conflict, so for that reason, that gives me a reason to oppose tariffs. That would be, he would be saying, I don't want conflict. That would be the value judgment. Just saying that tariffs produce conflict or make conflict more likely wouldn't itself be a value judgment. It would just be saying something has a particular consequence. Again, I'm glad you asked this because it's a very important point. So the key point is if you say something has a particular consequence, that doesn't become a value judgment just because you or most people either like or dislike the consequence. You see what the key point is. Okay, so now we're going to get to, I said, the basic point in evaluating tariffs is a very simple one. Now, remember in the lecture last week, we were talking a lot about the consumer sovereignty and in the free market, it's the consumers who are determining what's produced. Because suppose you're a producer, how do you make money? Say, suppose somebody leaves you $1 million with the proviso that you open a business. Now, so you want to know, well, what would you decide? What kind of business would you start? You must start a business with this money. But how do you know? Well, you try to figure out what is it that people want. And you would make money if you're able to satisfy the consumers. Now, suppose you're not making consumers good, but say you're in some other business, you sell to producers rather than consumers. That doesn't change the basic point, because you'd be trying to satisfy the producer's demand. For you, the producers would be, that you're selling to would be the consumers, and what they're doing is ultimately determined by what the consumers want. So it's the consumers' demands that are really powering the system. They're the consumers who are in control. They're steering, they're at the steering wheel, saying what the economy should be producing. And if you have something that interferes with this process, then it's going to reduce consumer welfare, because the free market is aiming to satisfy what the consumers want. So if you stop or interfere with the free market from working, then you're going to be interfering with the consumers getting what they want. You're going to be reducing consumer welfare. Now, here's a related way of making the same point. We can see it kind of on a, maybe in a simpler way, but we can just involve, say, two people. Now, suppose we have an exchange, let's say, you're exchanging your money, you're giving your money to the Mises Institute because you want to hear my lectures. I certainly wouldn't do that, but that's what you want to do. Okay, so you've given your money to the Mises Institute. So why did you do that? Well, because you thought you'd rather listen to my lectures than keep your money or spend your money on something else. And similarly, the Mises Institute is willing to sell you access to the Mises Institute would rather have the money than just restrict access to my lectures, prevent, I mean, they're better off the more people that they, paying people who have access to my lectures, because that makes money for them. So we have in this exchange, in any exchange, people are participating in the exchange because they expect to benefit. Say you go down to the store, you buy, go down to the grocery store and you buy something, you're buying that because you rather have what you buy than the money, and the person who's selling you the goods would rather have your money than the goods he has for sale. When I mentioned going to the store, it reminded me of the story of the wife of a computer programmer who told her husband, go to the store and get a loaf of bread. If they have eggs, bring back a dozen. So he came back with a dozen loaves of bread. Okay, prolonged laughter, please. Okay, so as I said, you know, this is a very simple point. When you have an exchange, all the parties to it expect to benefit, because if somebody didn't expect to benefit, he wouldn't engage in the exchange. It might be the other, some other person would want to exchange with him, but unless everybody in the exchange expects to benefit, there won't be an exchange. So what do you have if there's a tariff? Well, that's a barrier to exchanges that people want to make. Say you have say you have the, Malcolm says it's a techie, I'll remember that one. Oh, good. Oh, exactly, Malcolm, if I can just interrupt a second. You know, I'm not a, don't know much about computer programming. Why would a computer programmer be likely to interpret the sentence so it's taken that way, meaning if they have eggs get a dozen, why would the computer programmer be likely to code that as meaning as referring to the previous sentence about the loaf of bread rather than taking it as meaning if they have eggs get a dozen eggs? I'd be interested in finding that out, actually. Oh, I see. So you're following a fixed rule about that. Thanks. Okay, so as I say, in the free market, people engage in exchange because they expect to benefit. Now, what happens if you have a tariff? Well, let's take a case before. Suppose somebody wants to buy a car from Toyota because he'd rather have the Toyota than the amount of money he'd have to spend on it. Similarly, Toyota wants to sell him the car. They'd rather have his money than the car. Now, tariff is saying you can't make that exchange. It's an exchange you both wanted to make, and you can't make it. So a tariff really, it's really equivalent, say, to preventing, imagine we have people who are trading with each other, say they're at a far distance, and they have sort of some way of transport, so they have a bridge or a railroad. That's how they get goods to each other. Now, we know that this whole process of increasing the market is very beneficial because you don't have to, in the free, if you have to produce everything by yourself, you wouldn't get very far. Almost everybody would die if you had to, say, grow all your food or yourself or build your house yourself. What we do is we each specialize in something, the division of labor, and then we trade with other people for the things we need. And the greater the market, the better. Then we can extend division of labor and we can get more and more things we want. So to extend the market, say we have bridges or railroads, airplanes, these are all making trade easier, they make trade possible, so they facilitate the exchanges people want to make. Now, suppose people are engaging in trade, say there's one town some distance from another, and there's a bridge between them, and then you destroy the bridge, then that isn't going to be very good for the people on either side, because previously they were trading with each other, they benefited from that, and now you're destroying the bridge. Similarly, we could imagine a negative railroad. Instead of a railroad connecting people, imagine something that would have a barrier making trade more difficult. So a tariff is like that. It's just saying people want to make an exchange, but the government is now interposing a barrier, it's making it more difficult for them. And remember, they remain in exchange because they expected to benefit from it. So the tariff is thus interfering with their welfare by doing that. Now, Hazlitt, in his chapter, gives a good example of how tariffs would hurt consumers. Suppose people buy an imported sweater for $10. You can tell he wrote this book in 1946, so prices were rather lower then. So now, let's say a tariff is imposed, it's a pretty heavy tariff. So now the same tariff is available more cheaply domestically. Now it doesn't, people want to buy the sweater, will find it's a better bargain to buy the sweater domestically, but now they have to pay $15. So let's assume the tariffs, I mean, the sweaters were basically the same in quality. So now they're going to have to pay $15 for this sweater, and before they were paying $10. So now they're worse off because they have to pay $5 more for the sweater. They have $5 less to spend on other things or to save up. So we can see very directly how the tariff is hurting the consumer because it's the protective tariff because it's making the products that he buys more expensive. Now, as I say, this is a very simple argument, so we have a problem. Well, why is it that tariffs are pretty popular? There are a lot of, we have tariffs, we've always had them in the U.S., and a lot of people will defend them. So you might wonder, well, how can they do that? Isn't this a pretty simple argument? But there are a lot of defenses of tariffs that people give. One is, a defender might say, well, you're right, these consumers are worse off. It's certainly you're worse off if you have to pay $15 for a sweater and you're paying $10 before. But look, the consumers are worse off, but the producers of sweaters are better off. Because what would happen without the tariff in our example? Well, then the foreigners would be supplying the sweaters, but now the sweaters are being supplied by Americans. Assume we're talking about American tariffs. So defender of tariffs would say, look, the function of the job of the American government is to protect Americans. Foreigners are really, they have to protect, their governments have to protect them, but the job of the American government is to protect Americans. So you might be right that American consumers are being hurt, but look, producers are better off because now, look, these sweater sellers and manufacturers are better off. So if you say we shouldn't have tariffs because it hurts the consumers, you're just making a value judgment. You're just saying, I prefer to protect consumers, but what if people think it's more important to protect producers and consumers? You don't really have an argument against tariffs. You're just saying my preference is for the consumers, but the supporter of tariffs could say, look, I want to help the producers. Now, one thing that's a fundamental thing that's wrong with that argument, it is making a contrast between producers and consumers that isn't right. Because we have to remember the consumer is also a producer. And what do we mean by that? Well, suppose let's take our person, the consumer, the one who has to pay the higher price for the sweater because of the tariff. Well, how is that person getting the money to buy the sweater? He has to generate some source of income. He could get, aside from people get money from gifts or inheritances or things like that. But in general, if you demand something on the market, you have to supply something in return. You say, I get money by, I work for the Mises Institute, so I'm, my demand is based on services that I get money because I supply certain services to the Institute, and then in return I get money for that. So fundamentally, we could actually have this in a barter economy. We have the demand for one product is really supply of another product. The way I demand product is supplying product of my own. We can see this in an exchange, like suppose I exchange apples for oranges. So one person's supplying oranges, the other person is demanding oranges, and that person's demand for oranges is his supply of apples. So really, the supply, the supply of one product is the demand for another product. The introduction of money doesn't really change this. And this is what's called Say's Law after Jean-Baptiste Say, the early 19th century French economist who wrote about this. So what's wrong with this rejoinder to the anti-tariff argument, with the anti-tariff, argument was, look, tariffs are hurting consumers. The rejoinder is, well, they might hurt consumers, but they help producers, is that, no, consumers are also producers. So it might, tariff might help one group of producers, but it's also hurting other producers, namely the consumers. So there isn't, it isn't the controversy between pro and anti-tariff advocates isn't one between those who favor the interests of consumers against those who favor the interests of producers, because consumers are also producers. So, as I say, it's only certain producers who benefit from a tariff, not producers in general versus consumers. In the example I gave, it would be the people who sell sweaters who benefit from a tariff on foreign sweaters, not producers in general. Or in the example of the cars, it would be people, manufacturers of American cars, who would benefit from a tariff on foreign cars. So it is true that a particular producers can benefit from a tariff. Suppose you're you're producing American cars, and you would be without the tariff. You wouldn't sell very many because a foreign car is a better bargain. Now you have a tariff, so you're able to sell more cars. The consumers will now buy from you. So clearly you benefit from the tariff, but even those producers who do benefit from a tariff lose, because when they're consumers, they have to pay higher prices as a result from other tariffs. It usually isn't the case, almost never be the case, that you'd have just a tariff on one or two goods and everything else is free trade. You'd have all sorts of different tariffs. So each industry that benefits from a particular tariff, the people in that industry, will lose, because then they have to pay higher tariffs. So the only people who really are net gainers from tariffs are producers who get more from their tariff, the tariff that benefits them, than they lose in paying higher prices from other products that gains from the tariff. So say the sweater maker gets more because he's now able to sell the sweaters because of the tariff, but then he might have to pay higher prices for other goods that he wants. So it's not clear that he benefit on net from the tariff. It would just depend on the specifics of the situation. Now there's another very popular argument for tariffs. This wasn't actually discussed, I don't think, in our readings, but it's one that Mises and Rothbard discussed elsewhere. Some people say, and this is a popular argument, Alexander Hamilton used this argument, was very popular with a 19th century German writer named Friedrich List, L-I-S-T, say, well, free trade is all right once an industry is developed, then free trade is good, because whichever company is the most efficient will sell the most, and consumers will benefit because they'll be buying from the most efficient industry. But suppose you're in a country like the U.S. just getting established, and you want to start a particular type of business. So it's going to take a while before you can build up your company till it can compete on reasonable terms against foreign businesses that are very well established. And what the idea of the infant industries argument is that if you have a tariff, that can let an industry develop. So without the tariff, the industry couldn't get off the ground because, say, the foreign well-developed industry could always out-compete it. But if you have a tariff for a while, then the industry will build itself up, develop an internal market, it'll be able to get better equipment. And then, after a while, you can take away the tariff and the business has grown to such a point that it can now compete with the foreign industries without the tariff. So the idea is you need the tariff can help the industry while it's in the stages of growth till it's in a position to compete with the already established foreign industries. Yep. Mises makes, I think, we had this, some of you took my last course on capitalism. Mises raised the point in the readings for that course, I thought it was an extremely good point that he made. It isn't generally made in discussions of infant industries. It seemed like an extremely good point, is that we ask, how does an economy grow? It's really only if capital increases, by meaning capital goods. It's only, say, if you want a growing economy, if you want the economy to increase, you have to devote more goods not to immediate consumption, but you have to devote goods you use for the production of other goods. So you build up, you develop what they call in Austrian economics, the structure of production further. You devote more resources to producing goods that are used not for consumption, but for production of other goods, to capital equipment. And if you don't have, what happens if you don't increase your capital equipment, then the economy won't grow. If you don't increase capital, then suppose you support the infant industry, you'll just be taking away resources from other firms. So you supporting the infant industry, you're helping that industry to grow. But at the same time, if there hasn't been an increase in total capital, you're taking resources away from other firms. And remember, people in the free market prefer to spend their money on the other firms, not on the infant industry, because it requires government action to support the infant industry. So again, even if the infant industry develops, you're still taking away resources from other firms that people in the free market preferred. Now, but what about, let's address this point about the infant industry. Isn't it true, though, aren't there cases where it takes time to build up a new industry? So unless you have some kind of subsidy, the industry at first, then you're not going to get it to develop. Oh, let me just see. Jack has a question here. If foreign sweaters were $5, American sweaters were $8, a tariff of $5 were put on foreign sweaters, making them $10, would the American producers still charge $8 or charge $9 since foreign t-shirts cost $10 now? Well, what would probably happen there is that the price of American sweaters would rise because there'd be an increase in quantity demanded of these sweaters, since people wouldn't be finding the foreign sweaters a good buy anymore. So people would start demanding the increase their demand, quantity demanded of the American sweaters, so price would probably rise. Okay, so but getting back to infant industries, what about these cases? Well, look, it takes a time for the firm, the industry to develop. won't be making a profit at first, but if you subsidize the industry, then after a while it will be able to make a profit. Aren't there cases like that? But if you have a good profit opportunity, but it's only in the long run, not right now. Well, if people think that, they can certainly invest in such a company if they say, well, we might lose money now, but we're willing to stay the course. We think we'll make it up in the long run. And why would it be necessary to bring in the government? We would think if there are such cases, as there probably are, where something is not such a good opportunity now, but if you wait a while, it will be. Investors in the market would be in a better position to judge that than the government would, because if you're an investor, the investors are the ones who succeed because they're good at investments, they're good at spotting such opportunities, whereas the government, people in the government succeed not because they're skilled in business, they're skilled in anticipating what the consumers want, but they're rather bureaucrats aiming at power, certainly not at satisfying the consumers. And if another problem with infant industries is that, in fact, remember the point of the infant industries tariff is that, well, we start off with a tariff till the industry builds itself up. Then once it's in a position to build itself up, then we take away the tariff and now can compete on equal terms with foreign well-established companies. Whichever satisfies the consumers will win out. So we have tariffs to begin with and free trade later. There's an argument that Friedrich List, that German writer, 19th century writer, used. He said, well, we have to have tariffs first and then free trade when the economy's more developed. But in fact, the infant industries never grow up. Say we still have tariffs today on the steel industry. We can't describe, the steel industry isn't an infant industry anymore. But once a tariff is established, it's very hard to get rid of it. So very often infant industries argument is just using the excuse for a tariff, but they keep going long beyond the supposed period of infancy. Now, here we get to the point I raised earlier. I said, for the most part, we can say criticism of tariffs don't involve value judgments. When Mises said, or Rothbard said, here's what a tariff, what will happen if you have a tariff. That isn't an appeal to value judgments, just saying this is what's going to happen. If you don't like that, well, then that you're making a value judgment, but the fact that you're pointing out this consequence isn't itself a value judgment. Just as to say, if you say smoking increases your chance of getting lung cancer, that isn't a value judgment. The fact that most people don't want lung cancer doesn't convert the statement smoking causes lung cancer into a value judgment. But what if the defender of tariffs says, well, you point out a lot of bad effects of tariffs, but I still want it anyway. And so I said, well, look, I just want to help a particular producer. It's very important to me that we have American cars or an American manufacturing, strong American manufacturing part of the economy. So even if that hurts other people, this is what I want. So what Mises says there is, well, he can't argue directly against them. He could just say, I don't have that value judgment. But he couldn't say that they made an economic mistake as long as they admit the bad effects of what they're favoring. Just like in my example, suppose somebody says, a doctor, okay, smoking is going to increase my chance of getting lung cancer, but I want to smoke anyway because I value the satisfaction I get from smoking more than I don't like the risks of getting lung cancer. Then the doctor really couldn't say anything except he might demand early payment of his bill, but he couldn't really say much anything directly against that person. So as I say, in this case, an opponent of tariffs can't reject them without introducing a value judgment. And there are other defensive tariffs that someone could give that you'd have to use a value judgment to reject. For example, suppose somebody said, I think someone asked about this in a previous lecture. Suppose somebody said, well, we need to stockpile materials in case of war. There might be good reasons not to do that. You might say, well, we could get them even if there was war. But if somebody said, look, tariffs are going to have all these bad economic effects, but I think we need to stockpile materials anyway, then if you rejected that, you'd be just giving a value judgment of your own against what that person has said. But Mises has a good point about these cases, that's say cases where the person who favors tariffs says, look, I acknowledge the tariff has all these bad effects, but it's just I want to have certain goals I want to achieve by the tariff, and I favor those in spite of all these bad effects. So what Mises says there is those reasons for supporting tariffs should involve expenses. For example, suppose you say we want a tariff because we need to stockpile a certain supply of material. And to do that, you'd have to spend money. And if you say, well, I want a strong American manufacturing sector, so that's going to impose a cost on others. And what Mises points out is people who support tariffs for those reasons don't acknowledge that they are expenses. What they say is, it isn't that we say, well, the government should just have expenditures of certain kinds. They say tariffs will increase production. If they say that, then they just show they're wrong because tariffs might increase production of a certain product, but they will have all these, they won't increase production in general. In fact, they'll be interfering with consumer welfare. So someone's free to say, well, I just want to help this particular group, but that's an expenditure. That's not an addition to production. Now, one other argument, we can see there are a lot of pro-tariff arguments, is what about employment? You can say, don't tariffs add to jobs at home? Let's say a foreign company replaces a domestic company. Let's say, again, take this example, say we don't have tariffs on Toyotas. Now people start buying the Toyotas instead of the American cars. Isn't that going to mean that American car production will go down? What if workers in the domestic companies are out of a job, so aren't tariffs very bad for American employment? And again, the support of tariffs might say maybe they'll help foreign employment, but look, we're Americans, the government has to care about our citizens, people in America, not about foreigners. But again, this argument isn't right, because what happens if we buy foreign products? Then the foreign nations would get our money, and what do they have to do? Well, they have American money, say, what are they going to do with it? They would have to spend it or invest it on our products, should be products rather than projects, or exchange their money with somebody who's going to do that. If, say, you're in Japan and you've got American dollars, remember, that isn't the currency over there. So if you either will have to spend it on American products or trade it in, and the person gets, at some point the person with the American dollars will have to spend it or invest it in America. Of course, when the person does that, that's going to create domestic employment. So although it's true that free trade might cost certain people jobs if you're in a product that's out-competed, you're producing a product out-competed by a foreign product, you might be able to stay in business, or people work for you might have to lose their job and have to go elsewhere. But what this is forgetting is that the foreign spending is adding jobs because they are spending the money on the American product. So that's going to add to employment. And we can say in general that the free market allocates resources in the most productive uses. So we can expect then that employment will be more efficient without tariffs than with them. Now, as I mentioned, it is true that tariffs can help some workers. For example, if a business exists only because of tariff protection, without the tariff it wouldn't exist, then ending the tariff would mean that workers in that business will have to find other jobs. And it's not guaranteed that those workers will get as good jobs as the ones they had before. If they're in the job that they're in, they're in that because they thought that was the best alternative available. So if you take that away from them, it's probably likely they're not going to be able to get anything as good as that, because if it was as good or better, they would have been in the other job already. However, again, this is similar to a point we made about the manufacturers. Even the workers who benefit because of existing tariffs and be hurt were tariffs on their products abolished, they benefit from abolition of other tariffs, since they have now, they can buy at lower prices than before for other products. Now, the last argument I want to give is that some people say it's unfair to American companies to make them compete against foreign companies that pay low wages, because they say, well, look, American companies have to pay very high wages, but foreigners have in some cases have a very much lower standard of living. So how can an American firm say it's paying $25 an hour compete with some, say, an Asian firm that's only paying $3 an hour? Isn't that very unfair to the American company? But what we have to ask to analyze that argument is, how are wages determined on the free market? Basically, by how much workers produce. The employer won't be willing to pay more to a worker than what he produces, and if he tries to pay less, other firms will compete away his workers away by offering them more money. So if you have an American firm that's paying higher wages than a foreign firm, it would indicate that the American workers are more productive. So it isn't as if the American firm is producing the same as the foreign company, but the foreign company has an advantage because it's able to pay the workers much less money. The American firm will be much more productive. That would account for the high wages. So the high wages don't put the American firm at a disadvantage at all. And they're not at the disadvantage of this argument postulates. And if an American firm has to pay high wages, that's because those who work for them are in demand. Obviously, the employer would prefer to pay as low wages as he could and still retain the worker. So if he's paying high wages, that indicates his workers are in demand and he can has to pay them that amount to prevent them from going elsewhere. That would be what would happen. Now, Kevin said minimum wage law might make U.S. employers at a disadvantage. Well, if you have minimum wage law, then the employer would not be, it would just not employ those workers who were less productive than the minimum wage. So it would reduce employment in for particular people. So that would be the principal effect of that. It would put them at a disadvantage in that they could operate their business more efficiently if they were able to hire the workers at the lower price. Okay, so I think I've gone over a few minutes, so I think we'll stop there and we can have now the usual questions and refutations, so on. Well, here's a very long one. I haven't seen who it's from, but I bet it's from Malcolm. See if I'm right. No, it was from Jack. I thought because it was a long one, it was from Malcolm, but it wasn't. Okay. Jack got a response from VP Economist on Austrian. Oh, good. I remember, Jack, you were going to ask about Austrian business side. He says, I'm reasonably familiar with the Austrians. A bit like old school monetarism with more specific ideas about how cycles generate. I see much support for the idea in today's environment. I don't think the low interest rate environment is encouraging speculative behavior. Investors reach recklessly for yield. Everyone seems to be clinging to liquidity, including banks, who would be an important channel for the Austrian boom bust cycle. I think we'd like to see a little more risk-taking by investors. We're watchful for anything that hints at speculative behavior outside of farm real estate prices, which we think about speculation in crop prices, not monetary policy. I can't say I've seen anything that would suggest much speculative behavior out there, particularly in light of the huge size of our balance sheet, which I presume that Austin would have expected to be fueling a speculative boom. I need a reply for tomorrow if you could help. Well, Jack, what I suggest there, you should look at Mises' article in Economica 1943, I think called Elastic Expectation of the Trade Cycle. This is a very important article. So what the Federal Reserve person is saying, look, the bank, we have the increased bank credit, but it's not cause the people aren't investing, the business people aren't adding to investment. The Austrian business cycle says, well, they're going to take the increased bank credit and expand the structure of production, but they're not doing that. That's the basic argument he's giving. Now, what Mises is pointing out, well, what happens if they don't, say, the banks expanding the credit, and as in the case the Federal Reserve person is giving, the businessmen don't expand, then there's just not going to be a business cycle in that case. So what Mises is trying to do with the Austrian theory is explain the business cycles that do occur. In this case, there just won't be one, but it's still, the theory is still explaining how the cycle, how the boom arises when it does arise. It's just like, what would be an example of this kind of explanation? Suppose you say when the temperature rises, people tend to go to the beach. So it isn't a refutation of that statement. Sometimes when the temperature rises, people don't go to the beach. It's just the temperature rises will explain why they go to the beach when they do. So see, I think basically to answer your person by tomorrow, you just need to look at this 1943 article by Mises, which was applied to Ludwig Lachmann, Economica 1943. Okay, Kevin has some common objections. China's engaged in economic warfare against us. by sabotaging their industries, attempt to destroy our industries. Should we use tariffs to protect our industries and jobs? Well, I mean, what you'd be doing there, it doesn't matter how they're helping their industries. Still, as long as what matters is the result, they're helping American consumers by offering lower prices. So even if particular American industries can't compete, the lower prices that Americans pay will create other jobs, and also the Chinese get money from us. They have to spend it or invest it in the U.S. Why should we compete against slave? Why should we compete against slave labor people working at near subsistence levels? Must we lower our wages to compete against slave labor, child labor? Should we protect ourselves? No, remember this point I made. High wages reflect marginal productivity. So if the low wages or near subsistence levels aren't going to be very productive either, the American industries are not paying wages higher than the productivity of the workers, so they're not at a competitive disadvantage. Now, Leslie wants to know, what does the VP economist say about Stockman's recent analysis of both? I bet he doesn't put much stock in it, but I don't know. Travis said, I would pay to get Tyler Cohen's response to this. Oh yeah, yeah, Tyler, you know, I've known Tyler for many years. You know, he used to come to see me when he was a professor in Irvine. He would come down to Los Angeles to see me because he thought I was funny. I don't know if he still thinks so, but he did then. Now, Travis says, if someone decides to start a business, can we decide not to hire anyone to do all the work ourselves? Would that be considered capitalism? Would this be cynicalism or a mixture of both? We would still have private ownership of means of production. We each hold an equal share. So what system would that is classified? Oh, that would still be capitalism as long as you're producing for market. Syndicalism would be a system where it's not the market doesn't determine prices, but it's supposed to be all the firms in a particular industry would set the prices and wages themselves, and then you negotiate with other syndicates to establish prices for things that you negotiate with other syndicates if you weren't satisfied with the prices they were charging. So that wouldn't be a market system at all. But in a free market, you can have whatever kind of business organization you want. You don't have predominantly, say, workers' cooperatives because many workers don't prefer to be in that. They want others to take the risk. But people are certainly free to form that type if they want to, and still counts as capitalist. yes, I mean, as long as it's voluntary, it would still count as capitalist. Now, Jack said, why should the Fed be concerned with risk-taking business investors in the first place? I'd like to see a bit more risk-taking. Is the Fed the manager of risk for the market? Oh, yes, I think that's a good question. But the key point I was making my answer is that even if the expansion of bank credit doesn't result in increased risk-taking behavior, that isn't a counter to the Austrian theory of the business cycle, because that's trying to explain how the cycles that occur do occur. This would just be the example where an expansion of bank credit, but people don't invest, would just be, well, then you don't have a cycle in that case. But that isn't a contradiction to the Austrian theory. It's not a theory that if you have an expansion of bank credit, it's going to inevitably generate a cycle. It's just if you have the expansion of bank credit and business people respond to it by expanding the structure of production in a way that doesn't correspond to the rate of time preference, then that's what's going to cause the cycle. Travis says, yes, that's right. it's still capitalism. I mean, you can organize your means of production whichever way you want. Travis says, the workers technically still have private ownership. Well, not necessarily. I mean, they don't if they're working for a capitalist who owns the means of production. See, what you're talking about, a case where you could have workers who just own certain means of production and get together and in a business, and then instead of having a capitalist owner who pays them, they just do things themselves. But it wouldn't follow from that that every firm is one in which workers still have private ownership of the means of production. In many, if not most firms, it isn't the employees who own the business alone. Some cases it can be. I mean, you have many employees have shares of stock, but it just depends on the particular case. Now, Jack says, I was also getting criticism today because inflation not meeting Fed's expectations, and the quantity of money is expended. What is my explanation of why prices aren't higher? Well, basically, there you have to come to lecture number 5 on, right, I talk about inflation in the business cycle. Basically, the point is, in the Austrian theory, there isn't a fixed mechanical relationship between increases in the quantity of money and how prices rise. It just depends on particular market conditions. And in the Austrian view, what you do is when there's an increase in supply of money, then you have to trace it in its effects throughout the economy. You see. So now, Travis, the answer why prices aren't even higher, well, it just because there's no fixed relationship between how the quantity of money increases and the how much prices rise. It, you can say without the quantity of money, prices aren't rising as much as they would have as they do with it, but you're not really able to make quantitative assessments of this, at least not according to the Austrians. But Travis says, so how would that still be capitalism, speaking of private ownership reduction definition? Well, so you have, in a capitalist system, you have individuals who own all the capital goods. You don't have the government owning these. So then the individuals who own the capital goods can, what are they going to do with them? Well, they can hire laborers to work them and produce things. Or instead of doing that, they can pool their capital with other people who own capital and then just establish a business in which they all own the business together and they're all workers, but they own all the capital equipment. So those would both be examples of capitalism because they're ones with private ownership of the means of production. Isn't there some central body who's owning the means of production, you see? Now, Helen said, I've seen some good prices are higher, others lower, but quality has declined. Is that a consequence of inflation? Well, you just have to know what the particular circumstances were with each good. You know, you do have cases where, say, a business doesn't want to increase its price even though there's greater quantity of money, it just doesn't want to increase the price because it's afraid if it does that, people might stop buying it. And it will respond by lowering the quality of the product. So that can certainly happen. Now, Leslie says, is the price of gold affected by hints that Bernanke, the Fed will tighten up and stop easing? Well, I don't really know how the gold market works too well. You know, I used to have two very good friends who were in the worked for a gold company. They're very Camino clients. I knew Bert Blumert and George Rush. They were, especially George Rush, a very good friend of mine. But unfortunately, they're no longer living, so I could ask them, but I don't. I can't do that anymore. So I suspect the answer to your question is yes, but I'm not really up on the gold market. And Travis says, that's what I was looking for. Oh, good. Good. I'm glad that was of help to you. And Malcolm says, I look at chess as a point for an interposition between two or more parties. If they interpose itself between two or more parties, they can directly or indirectly go those who are advantaged or disadvantaged. There's always distortion where the general consumer is always in. Would this be a correct analysis with interposition? Yes, I think that's a very good way of understanding it. Yes, I mean, it's people want to make an exchange of a state and say, no, you can't do that. So I think you're exactly on target. Jack says, my guess is even though Fed says they will be using QE, I doubt they will. If I am in trouble for an economy, they will increase QE tenfold. Well, you may well be right. I mean, you're closer to the Fed than I am. So you may well be right about that. But I say I don't know the gold market or Fed policy. I wouldn't presume to be able to predict where the economy's going. I can't even predict where I'm going. Oh, it just reminded me, July 4th is coming up, isn't it? I have to better watch it with the firecrackers. I hope I don't blow my face off again this year. Most people thought it was an improvement, but it was too painful. Gotcha. Well, let me just get my regeneration. As long as it isn't degeneration. Now, Kevin says, is it technically possible for the Fed to run out of qualifying collateral to continue to monetize? No assets left to monetize. Well, I suppose in that the Treasury could certainly just issue fiat money. I don't know whether the Fed could do it. It would certainly be possible just for the government to print new money as they did in the Civil War. Was it a sparkler? They could monetize sparklers. That would be a punk thing to do. And I remember one other story about firecrackers. A little boy came home from school and he said to his mother, I just left some firecrackers under the teacher's chair and lit them and ran out the room. So the mother says, that's terrible, that's terrible. You go right back to school and get them out. And he says, what school? I'm having, you know, it's coming up July 21st and 27th is Mises U, and I'm scheduled to give the introductory praxeology lecture, so I have to come up with some appropriate jokes for the students. praxeology humor is rather limited. Yes, you're right. I probably won't use that one. Jeff says they're not concerned with inflation. They just paid banks not to lend money out. Yes, I mean, it's very difficult to follow Fed policy. I thought Stockman has a very good analysis of all that material. I have to do a review of that. It's just such a long book. It's hard to keep for me to keep up with all the details, but I hope I'll be able to finish that soon. You know, it is funny how people just go in for tariffs no matter what. Now, Pat Buchanan, whom I know was very strongly in favor of tariffs, and I mean, he knew Murray Rothbard, but he still said, oh, well, we've got to build up strong manufacturing sector, so he wanted tariffs anyway. Now, Helen says, doesn't Fed want banks to lend money to replenish money supply? I'm not really up on current Fed policy. It's much too confusing for me. Now, Dan says, Rothbard and Buchanan were both against NAFTA, but for different reasons. Yet, I think Buchanan was against because he just thought that this would lead to kind of an international control of American trade, and he generally liked higher tariffs, and he thought that would lower tariffs. But Rothbard said, no, well, this isn't real free trade. It's just a bureaucracy that's setting trade regulations. But they got along personally very well. Oh, Dan said, Justin Rana said he, Justin, played a role in getting Buchanan to run for president. Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Yes, I remember the Buchanan run for president. Malcolm, as you know, if a recent MES week-long seminar was taped, will be available later. I think Danny would be the one to ask about that. Danny says, I've noticed inflation masking portions of the restaurant seem a lot smaller these days. Yes, it's like the story, you know, the man who went to a restaurant, he complained that the food was all bad and there wasn't enough of it either. Well, okay. Thanks, everybody. So RGS won't be posted, but hope to see you all next week. Okay, thanks, everybody.